to Outdoor Explorer, and I'm your host, Paul Tordak. On today's show, we'll be talking and learning from a couple of veteran outdoor professionals who have spent decades working and playing in Alaska's great outdoors. In the first half of the show, I'll have Jim Mahaffey, one of the pioneers of Nordic skiing and outdoor education in the state. Then I'll have Daryl Miller, longtime Denali Mountaineering Ranger, on the second half of the show. Hi, this is Paul Tordak with Outdoor Explorer. Today in the studio, I have Jim Mahaffey. Jim is a former UAF, AMU, now APU, ski coach, an outdoor educator, a builder of ski trails, a all-around outdoor mentor for many, many folks, including myself. Welcome to the studio, Jim.
Oh, thank you.
It's a real honor to have you in here. Why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself, how you got into the outdoors, and how you ended up in Alaska?
Well, I grew up actually in the outdoors. I had an innate interest in it, and my dad was a hunter. We always lived close to the forest, and so I did a lot of hiking, started hiking when I was 5 and 6 years old, and then began taking hiking and spending overnight when I got to be 10 or 11 years old, backpacking long before the term was coined. I lived in an environment where the high school I went to was rather large. However, they had only the traditional sports of basketball, football, baseball, track and field. And the things that I was really interested in, such as I could have been a cross-country runner. If I had skiing, that would have been my sport, although I was strong in swimming. They had no riflery, and so my recreation was centered around the outdoors and the close bond I had with my dad. And he and I shot all the time recreationally if we weren't hunting. So shooting was probably the one sport that I excelled in. When I got to be a little older, I've always been a strong reader. I love to read, and and so Dad would get magazines of hunting and fishing, and I developed, as I became an adolescent, I developed a desire to go to Canada or Alaska, not knowing any better. I didn't differentiate the two. I wanted to go to one or the other. And when I graduated from high school at the age of 17, at that time, that was in 1947, it was a time when we were all scheduled for the draft. I had a 1A card, and I knew that it wouldn't be long until I was in the service. And growing up during World War II, I had a very strong fondness for aviation. And so I decided that I would plot a course. Rather than win the Army, I would plot a course where I could go into the Air Force and learn the airplanes from the ground up, and then apply for cadets and get into flying. So when I graduated from tech school in the service, I had an option to go to Germany or Alaska, and of course that was a no-brainer. I chose Alaska, and that's how I ended up in Wendorf Air Force Base. And I spent all my free time, 3-day passes, long weekends, all my furlough time and so forth, hunting, fishing, backpacking, canoeing. And this was back in 1950. when the state was, it wasn't a state, it was a territory, which I reveled in. I liked the idea of a territory rather than a state. And after I got out of the service, I actually got into fishing. And so for a number of years, I commercial fished. I had my own boat down in Southeast Alaska. And then in the winter, I would ski race and go to school in Colorado. I should say that somewhere along the line, I had abandoned the idea of joining cadets and flying in the service, because at that time the GI Bill was reinstated. This was during the Korean War. The GI Bill was reinstated, and so I had a chance to go to college and ski race at the same time. So I chose a very prominent small school in Colorado. They had an outstanding ski team, and I skied 4 years of varsity there. And what I actually, my goal had shifted from aviation to wildlife. I wanted to become a wildlife biologist. And partway through my junior year, I began to discover that there was a lot more to physical education than just simply throwing out a ball. And so I decided to, it was too late then, I had a major in zoology and another major in history. So I went ahead and got my bachelor's, and then when I went back to graduate school, I concentrated on physical education. And toward the end of my graduate experience, I had an offer to come to Fairbanks and assume the job there as a physical educator and the ski coach. And at the same time, the Peace Corps had contacted me to teach jungle survival down in Puerto Rico, which at the time was a lot more appealing to me than coming up to Alaska and teaching in Fairbanks especially. Mm-hmm. And so I didn't know anything about jungle survival, but I was pretty well versed in subarctic survival, and I knew I had a very strong sense of self-confidence. So, you know, by that time I was 30 years old, and I thought, people were saying, because I'd been a ski bum, people began to say, well, when are you going to get a real job? So I thought, well, I guess I better go to Fairbanks and and get serious about this whole thing. So that's how I got, that's how it came to be that I was teaching and coaching in Fairbanks. I built a pretty reputable ski team there, but I was there 5 years, but the last 2 years, Alaska Methodist University, the athletic director had been trying to persuade me to come down to Anchorage and build a ski team. At the time, they had what amounted to a ski club, and they wanted to have a ski team. So I came down in 67, and assumed I was a physical educator, and we had quite a PE program then. We had actually a professional program. We were producing well-qualified teachers in physical education, as well as I set about to build a ski team. And this was the old NCAA ski team consisted of cross-country skiing, downhill racing, slalom racing, and jumping. And we actually had a small jump on campus that we built the year I came down, really. So because we needed trails to ski and also teach fitness on, I began building trails on the AMU campus, and that's how the trails on the campus originated. At the same time, there was a real push on to get some trails in Anchorage, because at that time cross-country skiing was just getting started and coming on strong. And the school system had embraced cross-country skiing as part of their curriculum. And that was very instrumental in producing outstanding young cross-country ski racers from Alaska. So where do we go from here?
Well, that's great. So along the way, you started the Equinox Marathon, correct, when you were in Fairbanks?
Two of my skiers and I established the Equinox Marathon, and I ministered that for 4 years, I guess.
That's fantastic. And then also when you came to Anchorage, you helped get the Tuesday Night Race Series.
Well, the Tuesday Night Race Series actually were part of my varsity ski training program. We trained 5 days a week and then took long hikes on Saturday. And on Tuesday night, that schedule always called for a race, a foot race on campus, which at that time we had 500 plus acres. And I had a 10-kilometer course and a 4 and a 10, yeah. And I had just a ski team, but there were people in Anchorage, a very few people, but there were people in Anchorage who did run. There was one club in particular, the Pulsators Club, and then there were several runners who, virtually no opportunities for runners then. So I opened the whole thing up and invited anybody who wanted to come and join in with the Tuesday night ski team to do so, and quite a number of people did, including some of the Pulsators and so forth.
That's great. Now that those racers gets up to over 1,000 people show up. We had the 50th anniversary here this last fall at APU.
I had the honor to. I was requested that I make the ceremonial start on that, and I had the honor to do that.
Now, you also, I recall, I started at APU in the late 80s, and I remember we crossed paths there a little bit down in the basement at Atwood Center, and I recall you talking about that. You also built the first lighted ski trail in Anchorage.
Oh, that's true. Now, it's continuous. You know, at Russian Jack, which at that time was really the only ski area, cross-country ski area for the public. And they did have a lighted single course that went down the golf course and back. But I had a loop. I had a 1 kilometer course around the existing buildings, which at that time was Grant Hall and the Student Union Building. And I had laid out a 1 kilometer course around there. And of course, in the wintertime, it gets dark. And my students would daily ski practice started at about 3:30. And so we needed lights for that. So I laid out a course, and using some of the existing paths. And then the ski team brushed out the rest of it, and then the maintenance department put in the lights for us, and so we had a 1 kilometer lighted course.
Nice. Yeah. And how did you groom it? What was the grooming back then?
Well, the grooming, and though this was pre-snow machines, and so the grooming was done by we used take the whole team, and the first guys would go through on with snowshoes, and make it wide enough so that you could put a track in and also a pole track for the ski poles. And then a really good, knowledgeable setter, and I usually did the setting, put in the tracks, and then the rest of the team would come behind and ski those tracks in. And then the last person would be also knowledgeable. He'd come along and make sure that the tracks were correct and so forth. And then by the next day, they would set up pretty well, and we had pretty good tracks.
That's right. And not a lot of those trails are either part of us. That was back when we were classical skiing, diagonal skiing.
Only yeah. Classical. There was only classical. Skate skiing didn't come in until 80. I remember I was chief of course for the 83 and 84 World Cups. The 83 World Cups were in Anchorage, and I don't recall any skating there, but then I was chief of course in Fairbanks for the 84 World Cup, and by that time skating was starting to be used.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Now you also had a very successful Nordic ski team at AMPU, including having some women, which was sort of a pioneering thing.
Well, actually, yeah, I didn't, you know, my ski career, my racing and coaching career prior to coming to Alaska had no women. There weren't any women skiing. There were some women skiing alpine, but there weren't any women skiing cross country. So when I got to Fairbanks, there were already a couple of young ladies that were on the team. And so I just didn't even think they were part of the team. And that's how we got started. So I had some pretty good women cross-country skiers in Fairbanks. But I didn't have four or five. And so... yeah, when I came to Anchorage at AMU, we pretty much started right away, including the women. And I had a couple of young ladies from Vermont who came up who were interested, because at the time I had the only women's cross-country college, NCAA. Well, actually women weren't in the NCAA yet. So we were quite renowned for a little while. And I coached the Junior Nationals. Alaska's first Junior National team was in 1964. And I coached that team. And I was actually the alpine coach and the cross-country coach. that Junior National was in California. And then in 1967, that was the first year that Junior Nationals had an event in the cross country for women. Prior to that, they had an alpine program, but no cross country. So that was back in Duluth, Minnesota. We went back there with four girls and just swept up everything.
That's right, yeah.
Yeah. And then the next year, the East woke up, and then Rocky Mountains woke up. So within a couple of years, we had a real competitive environment.
Well, yeah. For women, and now that's sort of translated into the APU ski team and the great success Kiki Randall's had and the women there have had.
Yeah, that was actually the forerunner for that.
What I want to talk about also a little bit about, you also an outdoor educator. So you were talking to me earlier about having a wilderness skills class and teaching about wilderness also.
Well, yeah, well, AMU was... was very strong academically. President Fred McGinnis envisioned AMU as the little Harvard of the North. One of our well, one of the very strong instigators at the beginning of AMU was Gordon Gould, P. Gordon Gould, who was part Native, who grew up in the Aleutians, but his mother realized that he needed a good education, so she sent him. His father, in the meantime, had died, so she put him in the Jesse Lee home, and he went from a Jesse Lee home that was very successful. Ended up going back to Pennsylvania to a seminary. And became an ordained Methodist minister. But it was his dream to have a school, higher education for Alaska Natives. So we had those two, I won't say opposing visions for AMU, but they certainly were different visions. And we pretty much followed Fred McInnes's vision, and we had a very, very outstanding faculty. But you know, we were struggling. AMU, APU has always been short on funds, and I thought because of our unique location, so adjacent to the backcountry and the wilderness, that one of the things that we could capitalize on to our advantage was to have courses that were aligned in that direction, something we could do that other schools at the time didn't have, although they were coming on. But they were, you know, AMU was way ahead of the rest of them. And so I started the Wilderness Skills Program, which I taught. AMU at the time had what was called the block system, where the first month of the school year and the last month of the school year were completely four self-contained four-week courses with nothing else. You just concentrated on one discipline. And I taught the Wilderness Skills courses in May, our last month. And it consisted of classroom familiarization orientation. And then the following 3 weeks, we were in the field. And that included hiking, backpacking, and canoeing.
Mm-hmm. So that's great. I'm just sort of curious, in all your, I mean, you've done a lot of trips, either with students or on your own. So I'm sort of curious if you have any particular moments that stand out. I know that you and your wife, Dee, and your son, John, did all kinds of things when he was pretty young. So just, do you have any stories or any particular trips that stand out in your mind as particularly memorable?
Well, I don't know as I can boil it down to a specific trip. Some of our most enjoyable trips and probably unique trips were after I retired, and Dee and I, my wife, would drive up to Fairbanks, fly into the bush, and then fly out of places like Arctic Village or Venati to very remote heads of rivers, and then float for 10 days, 2 weeks, we'd float a day and then hike for a day. And so it was a combination of floating and hiking. One of those most unique trips was a trip to Banks Island, which is the westernmost island, a large island in the Canadian Arctic Archipelago. And we were there for two plus weeks, floating the Thompson River. And we drove our Volkswagen van from Anchorage to Inuvik, and then flew from Inuvik to Banks Island, and floated and hiked. And it was pretty unique in that we had musk oxen all over, including in our camp, and white wolves, and large Arctic hares, lots and lots of birds, including snowy owl nesting snowy owls. And the one thing I did want to see was the Peary caribou, which is a smaller species of caribou, subspecies. But Banks Island is a large island, and they seem to be all concentrated up in the northeastern corner. We never got to see any Peary caribou. And the other thing that I wanted to see that Dee wasn't very enthusiastic about seeing was polar bears. And we didn't see any polar bears, but that was a very unique experience.
Nice. What in all your time in the outdoors, with personal trips or with students, what are some of the significant lessons that you've learned, whether it's risk management or just being out in the wilderness?
I think one of the most important lessons that I learned was the cognizance of having to be especially careful with safety when I had these students out. You know, all my life I had been, up until that time, I had been pretty much traveling by myself. And young, strong, young, nothing, invincible.
Invincible, yeah.
Yeah.
Immortal, yeah.
Yeah. And then I slowly, as I taught more and more out in the wilderness, I began to realize some of the things that could happen. Avalanche, of course, and things like traveling early in the spring like that, traveling on ice, places that could give way. One of my most, I guess it was a lucky experience in that I was leading, we had crossed a small stream up in the Talkeetnas and had to climb up a very steep bank, high steep bank on the other side. And as I was climbing up the bank, I loosened a boulder about 2 feet in diameter, and it went crashing down toward my class, and I shouted down to watch out, and that boulder passed within probably 2 feet of the head of one of my girls.
Oh boy. Yeah.
And you know, I look back at something like that, and you can't prepare for everything. And so that was a You began to realize that you got all these inexperienced people that you've got to watch out for.
Yeah. Yeah, and they don't, they for sure can't anticipate things as well as you can.
They're completely innocent, you know, they babes in the woods.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Yeah. I have, this is Paul Tordek with Outdoor Explorer on KSKA. I have Jim Mahaffey in the studio with me. Jim, we really appreciate having your time in here, and I remember many of your stories about, I was swimming a sailboat at one point, and I said, hey, Jim, where's all the electronics? And you were like, oh, used a candle lantern for an anchor light, and you had a map and a compass of where to get around, or a chart, and it just blew me away that nowadays we're so used to all the technology and GPS and sat phones and depth finders. And here you were out, you know, in first fishing in Southeast and then in Prince William Sound with your family. None of that stuff.
That's right. That's correct. You have to pretty much rely on yourself under those conditions. You know, when I was fishing in Southeast, had my own boat and gill netter, and we'd go out at the noon on Monday and we'd fish right straight through until Friday noon, 24 hours a day. And that meant we were out there in all kinds of weather in the dark. You know, it gets dark down in Southeast. Fishing in the dark and so forth. I didn't have a radio, none of those things. And
Yeah, so
we survived.
Yeah, well, yeah, through a lot of skill and a lot of knowledge and a little bit of luck.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, Jim, thank you very much for coming in and chatting with us today.
Well, I like to tell stories, but I was a little apprehensive about this. But it's an honor, you know. It's an honor to have been, you know, thought enough of that it was worthwhile for me to come in and and tell stories. You know, I like to tell stories, but I kind of have to back off on it because my wife Dee frowns on my story. So I have to temper.
Oh, well, we always enjoy him. So no matter what he has to say. Well, thank you very much. Again, this is Paul Torlak with Outdoor Explorer on KSKA.
You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. Find the show anytime as a free podcast in the iTunes store or connect with us online at alaskapublic.org.
Hi, this is Paul Torlak with Outdoor Explorer. On today's show, we are talking with our elders and learning some lessons from people who have been in Alaska, lived full lives in Alaska, exploring and teaching others, mentoring others. We'll have Jim Mahaffey, longtime Nordic ski coach, in the studio with me in the second half of the show. But right now I have Daryl Miller in the studio. Welcome, Daryl.
Thank you. Good to be here, Paul.
Thanks. We're thrilled to have Daryl here. Daryl was a longtime climbing ranger on Denali, around 18 years. He did, I believe, like the first circumnavigation of Denali that we sort of know of in the modern era, correct?
Well, it was actually the winter.
Winter, right.
Yeah. Right. There's been a number of circumnavigations, including Cook's in 1903.
Yeah.
And then some of Denali 3, and then one of Foraker. And then we did all three mountains from Talkeetna to Talkeetna. So yeah.
Quite the feat. And we'll come back to that. He's also just a fascinating as a veteran. He was a rodeo clown. He's got great stories about owning monkeys and baboons, and just a fascinating individual, the kind that is sort of the classic Alaskan unique character. So I'm really thrilled to have you. I want to start, Daryl, with the whole rodeo clown thing a little bit. And you got out of the military, and then somehow this windy, circuitous trail ended up in Alaska. And so at what point did you like think, wow, this sort of adrenaline-type activities were for you?
Well, I think after spending 12 years in the Marine Corps, I got out because of my dad's health. I wanted to spend the last few years he had. So I started ranching with him. And then, of course, I ended up at a rodeo one day and kind of filled in for a junior rodeo kids. And after a beer at the bar, people were talking about, boy, you were good. You're really good. You should go to a school. And I said, where would that be? And they said, Henrietta, Oklahoma, Jim Shoulders, 16 times world champion. So called him. Started training and running. And then in those days, that was 73, a lot of people weren't running yet. You know, in the military, we ran in combat boots. So I used to run on the ranch roads with the cow dogs.
Huh.
So when I got to school, it was a whole different level of the bulls were much bigger, and they weren't what we call muleys. They were bulls that really wanted to hurt you. And so a week of school was kind of the start of my life there. But the first day, I got hit by the first bull, and I know Shoulders, he just came over and said, you know, that's a great act, but at the rate you're going, you'll be dead by Friday. So I was going to leave, but I stayed, got through the school for, there was one other rodeo clown, and we had about 20 bull riders. So we had all their bulls, and they got 5 bulls a day. So when I got back, I went to work, and it just kind of became part of what I did in the summers, you know, and on the weekends. And I did it for about 3.5 years till 1977, and suffered a number of injuries, so I quit.
Yeah. So then you, then at some point you discovered climbing, it sounds like, and being out in the winter, and then eventually you ended up on Denali with Knowles, right?
Yep. I was told by my mentor at Northern Montana College in Havre, Montana, and he said that you should try Outward Bound or the National Outdoor Leadership School. So I went to Lander and took a winter course, liked it, and then I took another course and liked it. And one of the instructors, Lucy Smith, said you should maybe come to Alaska and climb Denali. You're good in the cold.
Yeah.
So that's how I ended up here in 1981 in June. And it was a pretty remarkable trip for me because it was humbling, very humbling. You know, didn't summit, got pretty sick with altitude sickness, blistered lips. I couldn't pace myself. I'd never been to altitude. So when I got off the mountain, I was not ever coming back, at least in my mind then.
And that you had very fortunate to have Lucy Smith and I believe Landon Hamilton as sort of your instructors. That is very unusual at that time to have two women at climbing at, especially Lucy, at very high levels.
Very high level, right. Yep. And she, I learned a lot from her and still see her. You know, occasionally she comes up here and volunteers for Iditarod. So she stays with us, my wife Judy and I, and it's been a friendship for a lot of years, and she's an amazing person.
Yeah, yeah, it's really incredible what those guys were doing back
yep.
then. And on that trip, you had quite the storm.
We had a storm that moved in on July 4th till July 13th. It was 9 days.
Wow.
And that trapped us at 17, and we just went underground is basically how we weathered out that storm.
Yeah. And did you, and you were on the Muldrow route? Is that where you
were? Correct.
Yeah.
We were on the Muldrow, and we were on the Harper Glacier at around 17,000.
Yeah. So here you are, you're up there, and you're, you get done, get your butt spanked, basically. Pretty bad. I mean, that's that story is quite famous, at least in the Knowles community. And no one died. They made it out of there, a lot of frostbite. But, so then what happened? Why did you come back? I'm never going back. Why did you return?
Well, the interesting thing for me is when I graduated from the college, I got a job at Colorado State University at CSU. And I had started climbing in 1978. And actually, with a friend, Dexter Hale, who lived in Great Falls, Montana. And as my life started changing, climbing, it was a good adventure, a really good adventures. And so mostly ice climbing in the winter. And so what we did after 3 trips and then going to CSU and Fort Collins, I got really involved in climbing because of the Colorado. You know, you could rock climb there pretty easy. So the climbing kind of took over, and then in 1986, we decided to come back with a group from the outdoor program. So we ended up on Denali again. And then I spent time in Aconcagua, taking groups there in Mexico. And as my job changed, I decided that I wanted to not be behind the desk. I wanted to be out. So I moved into a teepee and was teaching primitive living skills in the desert. And I tried guiding. I volunteered for the Park Service on a patrol. And one thing led to another, and I got a job in 1991 and ended up in Talkeetna. And I was going to be there for 2 years, and 18 years later, I was still there.
Yeah, that's fantastic. So over the years, let's backtrack a little bit. During that whole period before you got to the Park Service, what prepared you the most for your then career and as a climbing ranger?
I think that for me, the background, obviously 12 years in the Marine Corps, was pretty physical. Ranch work was pretty physical. I always liked the outdoors in general, and I think that what I really appreciated mostly was going to the National Outdoor Leadership School and on different courses, learning about, you know, there was just more to doing things and learning about the terrain, the history, the people. And it's a big deal, you know, when you start spending time in the outdoors, and there's a lot of people that'll say that, you know, it's one thing, you want to choose the right people that you're going with if you're going to spend a month or a week or even a day in the backcountry. It's just a different place because you necessarily can't walk away. You need them.
Yeah. And when you look for people, partners, or talk to people about choosing partners, what are your recommendations?
I think that you should, you know, there's a lot of trips that don't work out on Denali, for sure. The group dynamics fall apart. And I think one of the things that a lot of people don't understand is when you're roped to somebody, you know, when you're moving and you're in a camp and a perimeter, you can't go anywhere, and you have to sleep in the same tent, you better know that you're going to get along, and they kind of agree on a lot of things that you do, especially decision-making.
Yeah.
And I think once you start making decisions about your safety, it's important to trust the person that you're with.
Yeah.
And it comes in time, but there's a lot of trips on Denali that gets, you know, are busted because of group dynamics.
Yeah. This is Outdoor Explorer 91.1 KSKA with Alaska Public Media. When we're talking to Daryl Miller, a longtime climbing ranger in Denali, and one of the most decorated rangers and rescue rangers. And you talk about teamwork when you talk about those rescues, right?
Right, and it's almost all the time you're working with a team, and so almost every rescue that I've been involved in, it's for sure been a team effort, and it's so important, you know, because the rescues it takes, especially on a big mountain and in the Alaska range, and a lot of it's involved with air, whether it's helicopter rescue or whatever, it's it takes more than one person, and so you just happen to be a name that, you know, ends up with an award, but you got it because of a lot of people involved that made it happen.
Yeah, I think that's great. And that those teams, and I assume include the pilots and other rangers and
the staff at the ranger station, the dispatcher, the incident command, you know, it's real complicated, you know, and having worked with a lot of groups here, including like the Air National Guard, the Coast Guard, AMRG, the state troopers, and you see that all through there. It's the teamwork, you know, with all those agencies.
Yeah, and we're super fortunate in Alaska to have that, you know, those resources here and available to us. Do you think, how have things changed over your time, you know, as a ranger and even, you know, since 81 when you started coming up here in the climbing community and the rescue community?
I couldn't say, I didn't do a lot of climbs, a lot of places, but my experience tells me that there's a lot of, like the staff right now at the ranger station in Denali and Talkeetna, you know, there's some really great climbers, really good outdoor-minded people. And it's evolved. They're more professional. You know, And now, from avalanche to wilderness EMTs to swift water rescue to, I mean, you know, it's an amazing resume some of these climbing rangers have.
Yep.
And I think, too, that, you know, there's just more people reading in the paper. There's just more people going out and doing things quietly. You don't hear about them, but they're out there doing these climbs and doing these trips. It's amazing what people do here in Alaska, and especially the approaches that they have.
Right. Let's talk a little bit about your the circumnavigation trip. What year was that?
1995.
95. Mm-hmm. And you were with, who was your partner?
Mark Stasek.
Mark Stasek. And tell me a little bit about that trip.
Well, we decided in the fall of 94, there's not a lot to do sometimes in Talkeetna. You want to get out and do something. So we decided, Mark and I, that he had time off and I was furloughed. So we decided that what would it be like to go around Denali completely from Denali, from Talkeetna.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
So we figured it about 350 miles, and we're going to need some caches. So we put caches in January, and we decided to leave in February, and we decided, too, to go, instead of clockwise, go counterclockwise. That way, if it didn't work out the first 100 miles, we could bail and get out of, you know, harm's way.
Mm-hmm.
So we decided, once we started figuring everything out, we left February 17th, and we showed back up in Talkeetna on April 2nd. And so we were gone about 45 days, and, you know, a lot of things happened on that trip that we got lucky with some things for sure.
Give an example.
Well, falling in the river in the Chilina.
Oh, really? Wow. Yeah.
Yeah, uh-huh. And it was about 15 degrees. Below.
Wow. Yeah.
And when I went in, I went in just far enough into my armpits. And so I could, we had throw bags, luckily we took with us.
Yeah, yeah.
And Mark got me out in the second throw. But that was quite an experience. You could feel the current just kind of, and if your snow pig, which were our sled with our gear, if that had fallen in, that would have taken me for sure.
Huh.
So we got real lucky with that.
Did you change your setup after that?
Got off the river. We went, and the river you can make pretty good time.
Yeah.
But in the canyons, the river ice is much different.
Yeah.
So I've never traveled. I've crossed the river on ice numerous times, but not traveling for 100 miles or so.
Yeah.
So it was a new experience, but a really good backcountry experience.
Yeah. Huh. And how long did that trip take you?
45 days.
Wow.
And we had some pretty cold weather, but that was probably a good thing for us. And the terrain, you know, it all varied because you were traveling on rivers, and then you were on glaciers. And the glaciers we were more comfortable with.
Yeah.
But, you know, you're going around Denali and up to Muldrow and then crossing through Gunsight and on the Peters Glacier and then across on the north side and then back on the Chetatalotna and then over the Alaska Range again, you know, and down. So it was a trip of a lifetime.
And again,
we got lucky with weather.
And the I'll talk about scale of everything, how sort of always called the Alaska factor and yeah.
It is, and I always have told people, you know, the Alaskan mile, and that's what I wrote the story about, the trip itself. And because I always felt in Alaska, the mile was a little longer because the lack of trails. And so when you say you're going to do 20 miles or so in a day, that's a big chore in places where the alders and places that people, they always talk about tree line, but tree line's not so important as the alder line.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's more of a factor.
Yeah. Yeah, that can really slow you down.
Or
and
stop
stop you. I bet you had some long days in Alder in your lifetime. Yeah.
We have had some, you know, because the south side of Denali and the Alaska Range, there's a lot of alders and rivers. And it's interesting because on the north side, you have more black spruce and tundra.
Yeah.
And and the park itself. And the rivers, most of them you can get across the Braids and on foot. But there's very few or no rivers on the south side of Denali that you can, in the summer, that you can just walk across.
Yeah.
You're going to have a raft. And the pack rafts, of course, that's changed Alaska in a lot of ways, travel.
Yeah, and it's very remote.
Very remote.
Not only are things bigger than they seem, the miles seem longer, the mountains are bigger than they look, the distances are more than they look.
Yep. Yep. Yeah, the scale, it's just hard, especially when you fly over and you're looking at, and things are a little steeper on the ground, because we flew over with Jim Auchinneck, Brian Auchinneck, and Dave Johnston. We all went on the plane to look at the route that Mark and I was going to go do, and it didn't seem that steep on some of the climbs part, you know, but boy, on the ground, it's a whole different factor.
Yeah, yeah. And some of it is that everything's big and everything's steep, so there's no perspective of what, you know, something small is.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah. Now, the other thing that you were, as a ranger, I'm sure you saw your share of people succeeding and having fun, but you've also seen plenty of tragedies and had to deal with their families, right?
Yeah, especially the last 10 years, I became the South District Ranger, and, you know, it was more administrative duties, and including with the families, and the families being of a devastating fatality or accident or searches and missing people. And they're always very, very hard, and sometimes the climbers really either didn't or don't understand that, you know, the families don't get over it very easy. In fact, you know, it's so devastating. And working with the families, you know, the rescues are one part of it, because typically you're going to find somebody alive. But the searches, they're really hard, because, you know, how long do you search and actively search? And then you have to do what we call a survival analysis about on Denali, when it comes to altitude, do you know how much fuel they had? Do you know how much food they had? And, you know, things like that where you can call up. You can't just call a search off. It's you need to have some good evidence that why that you know you're going to do something like that, because if there's a lot of times the families come to Talkeetna, and, you know, on some of the accidents that I was associated with.
Yeah.
So it's a tough, you know, I feel so bad for so many of those families.
Yeah. And I imagine that the climbers don't necessarily think about that beforehand. That is one of the risks.
That's one of the risks, and and most of the time the families aren't climbers themselves, so they don't really understand. I think that, you know, the journey, you can manage your risk pretty good in the backcountry. If, I mean, there's some hazard, objective hazards out there that you may not be prepared for that happens, and that includes, you know, even avalanches. But a lot of times you can manage your risk. I could manage my risk much easier on Denali sometimes than I could manage my risk on the road.
In Anchorage, yeah.
You know, and it's you have a lot of say in what you do. You know, today you say I'm not going.
Right.
I'm just not going to the summit.
And when you have looked at these accidents and analyzed them, what are some of the things you've learned about causes of them? Or,
I think people get in over their head and they deal with dates, and especially on Denali, I saw so many groups that they, once you get up to 17 high on, you know, 17,200 on the West Buttress, they have 3 days or 4 days, and as opposed to just saying, you know, we're not going to make it. But for a lot of groups that not making the summit, and only half about average make the summit. But it's hard for them to go back and say, you know, because people ask, you know, did you make it? Did you get to the summit?
Yeah.
So a lot of people feel that their journey wasn't worth it.
Right. So there's pressure about time.
A lot of pressure about time.
Goal orientation.
And people, some been some tragic accidents here locked into airline schedules.
Oh, interesting, huh?
Yeah. Including not only, but in the ocean as well.
Because they have a plane to
catch. They catch and they're going to force it in some weather they shouldn't be in.
Yeah. Huh. So that's sort of the sober side of what we do in the outdoors. What are some of the joys? What are some of the rewards that you've had and you've seen other people have?
I think that to be so lucky to go, you know, in my lifetime, I was so fortunate to come to Alaska and get into the backcountry and be out there spending time with a friend or friends. And, you know, it's so big, it's so silent. And most of it was in the Alaska Range. And, you know, I did a lot of backcountry patrols. And some of the best times of my life were there in the backcountry.
Yeah.
But also in my times, some of my worst times.
Yeah. And I assume it probably made you a better person.
I think so. I think that you learn by your mistakes and you learn, you know, it's there's a lot of risk. And, you know, one thing that you didn't want to happen in the backcountry, especially as a climbing ranger, is to get rescued.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I think about that when I used to go out in the backcountry, that not to put myself in a situation I can't reverse and get back out.
Yeah. Yeah, well, yeah, there's probably a little ego there. Like, you don't want to end up on the front of the paper.
No.
One of Craig Medved's columns.
No.
That's great. I guess the last question I sort of have for you is, any parting bits of wisdom for people? If someone's out there 18, 19, 20 years old and likes adventure, and what should their next step be?
Well, I think that there's so many places that you can start with, but if you can find a mentor or somebody that's been in a group, you know, like Alaska Mountaineering Club, there's so many groups around that do things together, and they go and they have trips, and there's outdoor programs. But I felt going to the National Outdoor Leadership School was a big changer for me. It really showed me a whole different side of going into the backcountry and what that meant.
Yeah, and there's a lot of Knowles, Outward Bound, there's a lot of opportunities for people to learn. Well, I've had Daryl Miller in the studio with me. Thank you very much, Daryl, for your
time. Thank you,
This has been your host, Paul Torta. Thanks to my guests, Jim Mahaffey and Daryl Miller. And thank you for joining us today on Outdoor Explorer 91.1 KSKA, Alaska Public Media. Thanks to our producer, Eric Bork, and from all our hosts here at Outdoor Explorer, we'll see you outside.
Outdoor Explorer is a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. Theme music is by Portugal, The Man. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect the station or its underwriters. You can find Outdoor Explorer on Facebook and in your favorite podcast app. To see what's coming up on Outdoor Explorer and add your voice to the conversation, go to our website at alaskapublic.org.
Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.